Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
Today, I am very excited to welcome Dervla McTiernan, internationally best-selling and critically acclaimed writer, author of The Ruin, her crime debut set in Ireland, and her most recent novel, The Scholar. The Ruin was the first in the Detective Cormac Riley series, The Scholar the second, and The Ruin has been published in the United States, the UK and Ireland, and in New Zealand and Australia, where it was a top 10 bestseller. It has been named one of Lit Hub's most anticipated crime, mystery and thrillers of 2018, and an Amazon Best Book of July 2018.
Welcome to the podcast, Dervla. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me about The Ruin and The Scholar.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I loved and devoured both these books, and I read them back to back, and what I really enjoyed was the exploration of characters from the first book, such as Emma in the second. How did you decide to make her role in the second book a more significant one?
Oh gosh, it's a funny one, actually. Some of Emma and Cormac's backstory was in an earlier draft of The Ruin, but it was just too much, you know. I have a tendency to over-subplot, so my editor had to, you know, kindly suggest that maybe we needed to lose that bit from the first book. So it kind of moved out, and I didn't know if I would use it in the second book. And then Della's story came to me and Carlene's story came to me, and Emma was just a perfect fit for that. It seemed to be more about, you know, it was her environment. Obviously, the book is set in a university. It's set on campus where Emma would be researching anyway. And so she was just a natural fit. Plus, it always felt a bit funny not to give Cormac and Emma's backstory. I kind of felt like I needed to give the reader more about where they had come from and where they had started from.
Yeah, it's interesting because while I was reading The Ruin, I was really interested in Emma's backstory because there were little hints to it. I thought, oh, this sounds interesting. Their reason for moving and the little bit of controversy of them getting together in the first place. And so I was so pleased to see that Emma had this great role.
Yes, she's an important one. You know, she's an interesting character in her own right, I think. I'm kind of, because she's in the third book as well, which I've just finished, although obviously it's a bit early to be talking about that now. And I am kind of interested to see where their relationship goes because I don't actually have all the answers. I'm not really sure where it's all going to end up.
Just keep surprising you as you're writing.
Yes, exactly.
I really liked because of their relationship. You know, of course, it's a crime fiction novel, and of course, we've got the crimes to be solved and the investigation. But what I also liked was that kind of juxtaposition of the relationship, and especially the relationship between Cormac and Emma, because it raised many different issues, such as trust and how well you can really know a person. Were these interesting things for you to explore?
I think they always are. You know, I mean, when it comes to relationships, you know, I suppose the confidence that you have in your partner and the love that you feel for your partner, you know, I suppose love can lead to trust, can lead to too much trust in certain circumstances. And I was interested to see, you know, that question of blind faith versus informed faith. And when your trust is shaken by you know, what seems to be good reason, how you respond to that as a reasonable person. To me, that's kind of interesting. You know, I think I read a lot of books where the characters are very, very, very flawed, you know, really damaged people. And that can be fascinating and very, very interesting. But I'm also interested in people who are generally, you know, in reasonably good shape, but they're in really difficult circumstances, because that can be interesting too. I think life can be challenging enough without creating enormously exaggerated stakes, if you like. So for me, Cormac and Emma's relationship they genuinely love each other, but they are put in circumstances that just make their relationship really difficult and hard to navigate. And I think that we can maybe all empathize with that to some degree.
And I like how you said, you know, love can blind you, because then he thinks with his cop's mind, you know, and he struggles to separate how he feels for Emma and his instincts as a cop, and then knowing you can be blinded because you love someone. And I thought it must have been so interesting for you to then explore Cormac on a different and more personal level as well in the second book.
I think so. I mean, I think that point where he reaches, where he's trying to, he sees her as a cop, and then he just can't switch that off. He wants to switch it off, but he can't. And then he's thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't be switching it off. Maybe I need to be looking, you know, with really open eyes. But what does that do to your relationship once you've done that? Can you ever let that go? Can you ever forgive it? Can you ever move on when you have turned off the part of yourself that always sees your partner with rose-tinted glasses, you know? I think that's difficult, and I think that's probably the reality. I mean, if you consider a situation, say, where someone has an affair, that must be extraordinarily challenging for a relationship, because suddenly, you know, you see your entire history through a different lens. And then you have to decide whether you move on or not from there. So it's that difficult resetting of a relationship that I was interested in. And their circumstances just happened to be a little more dramatic than your average.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the idea of forgiveness as well, and if it's possible, and how much you can, you know, hurt a person, I guess, and, you know, whether you can forgive them. So I like those ideas in there as well. You know, obviously the crime part of it is a really important part, but I do like those kind of subplots as well. And you were saying you over-subplotted, which I find really, really interesting, which I want to talk about. I mean, I've never heard of anyone over-subplotting.
Yeah, I like layers, you know. I like layers in a story, and I like to see the threads come together. And I am easily bored, so I tend to add a lot. Add another, oh, that would be fun. Ooh, that would be fun. And it can get too convoluted. I think, too, my brain just works that way. You know, I was a lawyer for a long time, and I did commercial law, and those contracts tend to be 200 or 300 pages just on for a standard thing. And if it's more complex, you might have, you know, a 300-page contract and 4 appendices, which are, you know, equally lengthy. And they all link, you know, each clause links to another clause, links to another clause. So I need to know, for example, that if I change clause 2A part 3, that's going to impact clause 24B, clause 46C, clause 125D, and just kind of keep that mind map clear in my head. So I think I train my brain to think that way. And then obviously I've been reading novels all my life, and I just tend to, you know, I like to read many, many different kinds of novels, but when I write, I do tend to add the subplots.
Well, it felt quite natural, I think, as well, because they were police, and they don't just work on one case at a time.
Exactly.
So I thought it was very interesting, and it then allowed you to explore different things. You know, I thought it was important, the exploration of domestic violence, and not in the way we often perceive domestic violence, you know, in that kind of quieter way of control and isolation and that brewing anger of someone. I thought that was so interesting as well.
Thank you. I find that very interesting. I remember reading an article, I guess it was one of these online things, maybe a Facebook thing, but it was two brothers who had gone to media. Their father, I think he may even have killed their mother, I'm not sure, but it was certainly a very, very violent physical attack, and he was certainly sent to prison for quite some time. You know, he had killed their mother. That was the story. He had killed their mother. And they were very concerned about how media had reported the incident afterwards. And it was very much along the lines of the sort of thing we hear all the time. You know, he was a very good man. He snapped. Or, you know, a great friend and a good neighbour. You know, this is inexplicable. And they came and said, look, it wasn't like that. It may not have been evident to people around us what was going on, but actually our father was intensely controlling of our mother and always had been. And if there was a snapping, it was only because she had dared to try to strike out and live her own life. But actually, the violence came after a long history of him controlling her. And I think that I find it difficult. I mean, obviously, there are some circumstances where mental health is the issue. There are people who suffer psychotic breaks, and that's a very different thing. But there are circumstances where there's a history of domestic violence. It might not be widely known, and the final act comes after that long history. And that is not generally how these things are reported. Mm-hmm. And I understand the reason why. But I think that it can lead to a very sort of dangerous narrative around that subject.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that's why I found it particularly interesting, because it's how people are perceived from the outside, and no one knows what goes on between a marriage and a family, you know, behind closed doors, do they? So I found that such an interesting part, even though it was a subplot.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did. Found it fascinating. Now, I was going to say, we've kind of touched on it already, but 12 years spent as a lawyer, yes. I mean, you must be influenced by the stories you have heard and the things that you've been through in this career.
I think I am. I mean, some of it comes into the, I wasn't ever a criminal lawyer. I didn't do any of that work. But I had friends that I was in law school with and that I trained with and friends of friends where we'd be sitting around having a glass of wine or a cup of coffee and you'd hear the stories, you know. Small things that are still shocking if you're not part of the system. So I suppose those sorts of stories definitely would have had an influence on me because they're fascinating and terrible and they're the things that I kind of want to explore. And then, obviously, on just a practical level, as I mentioned earlier, just the way my brain works and the way my memory works probably is definitely more influenced by the commercial side of things.
And look, crime fiction is traditionally a little bit dark, you know. That's what people are kind of expecting. That's right. But I think, given your career and your experiences that you've had, I think it just gives a bit more depth to the books because you think, you know, these. Although they probably don't come from true stories, they come from threads of truth.
Mm, yeah, I think they do because, you know, so much of the book has to come from inside of you. You know, you can call it in. I'm sure, I mean, God, we all know writers who do call it in, but I think readers feel it. I think if you're not feeling something as the writer, if you're not having a genuine response to your own writing, there's no way a reader will. And the sorts of questions you end up answering in writing a book are the kinds of questions you carry around with you, you know? I mean, for a long time with The Ruin, I mean, I was born in Ireland in 1976, and I had a very happy childhood. I was really, really lucky. But the Ireland I was growing up in was very different for other children, you know, the kids who are in the industrial schools and in the mother and baby homes and those sorts of places. And when we found out in Ireland, as we have in Australia, you know, what was going on in these places, all of the abuse and the neglect, everybody was so horrified and shocked. And I remember, you know, the media would constantly report such and such a person was interviewed or, you know, we didn't know was the main response. We weren't aware that this was going on. If we had known, we would have stopped it. But, you know, the reality is many people knew or they knew enough. They knew something. And definitely in Ireland, we had a long history of sort of turning our eyes away. You know, if it was within somebody else's family or somebody else's business, we had this mentality of, that's not my business. I won't get involved in that. And therefore, there was room for all these terrible abuses to happen. And what I couldn't get my head around, the thing I really struggled with, is that the people who kind of half saw these things and did nothing are the people that I love. You know, they're my family. They're my friends, they're the adults who I could rely on when I was a child. And so trying to get my head around, well, how is it that really good people can allow bad things to happen? And that's a huge question because we all have to figure that out because it's still happening today. You know, really good people still allow terrible things to happen. And that, I think, was the big question I was trying to answer in The Ruin. I'm not sure I answered it very successfully because I don't think there is an easy answer for it, but I got snippets of answers here and there.
Yeah, and that is so fascinating. And you know, the funny thing is I had this very conversation with somebody the other day about, A, what can an ordinary person do? But then if you remain silent, does that make you in a way complicit? And we had this very long discussion about, well, what can an ordinary person do? And I said, but it kind of still makes you complicit, right?
Yeah. I think it does, and I think it's really hard because we're all so turned off and burnt out. Like, even if you step away from the thing to do with children and you just consider politics, and I mean, a lot of us are pretty horrified at what's happening
with
politics in many countries at the moment. And yet, I've seen people try to get, you know, nascent political movements off the ground and fail because people are just so burned out and unwilling to trust. And I get it because I'm the same, you know. When I see somebody on Facebook or something else trying to get something started, I kind of half read it. But do I say, you know what, this is great. Someone's trying to make something happen. Someone's trying to make change, you know, really build a world we all want to live in. I'm going to get on board. No, I don't. I go and make myself a cup of tea and I read a book. We won't change anything, I suppose, if we don't try and change that mindset, but I don't know how to do it. I mean, I certainly don't want to preach to anybody. I haven't quite figured it out yet myself.
Yeah, there was no resolution to our discussion. It's continuous.
That's the problem, right?
It's an ongoing point. That's it. But yeah, we did talk about sort of the busyness, the how we're just so distracted by our own busyness, and that's everybody, you know, with work and career and children and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, what time is left? And it's a pretty poor excuse, but we are so obsessed with the busyness of our lives.
Yeah, you know what? I think you're absolutely right. And I don't think it's a poor excuse. I think that's probably the reality. Like, in years gone by, there was a hell of a lot more time for volunteering or just being involved in your community. Now people are struggling just to get through the week. Mm. You know, they're trying to juggle childcare and kids and pickups and drop-offs, and somebody's sick, so you have to come out of work. And, you know, I mean, I've just recently given up my day job last October, which is hugely exciting. And this is the first summer holiday that one of us has been able to stay at home with the kids, as opposed to just trying, because we've got no grandparents in this side of the world, obviously, so it's just us. So just trying to juggle our leave and stretch it out enough to try and keep the kids out of childcare as much as possible over mm-hmm. the summer, and so on and so forth. Like, that's a real struggle for most people. There just isn't much room left for anything else.
Yeah, and it's a real stress too, because, you know, obviously yeah. you've got financial responsibilities, but you want to try and take care of your children the way you want to, and it's just endless. I've said this before, but I often think that this generation, you know, the first real generation of two working parents, because I know, you know, my mum didn't really work, and I know a lot of my friends are the same. Yeah. First generation of such change, we're this great experiment.
Yeah.
And in 50 years, they'll be writing this PhD thesis on us going, oh, wow, look what happened to them. Maybe we'll be okay. I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know. I think we're doing all right. I mean, I've got a few very good girlfriends here in Perth. They're all Australian. We talk about this stuff a lot because we all have young children. And my friend was reading the Steve Bidoff book the other day about raising boys, yeah. you know, and it was, she was like, well, I read the first chapter and I'm already stuffed. I think it says something like, you know, try really hard not to put your boy in daycare until he's like 2, I think it was. I mean, that's just not the reality for most people. Unfortunately, I wish we could do it, but the reality is most of us are back to work a hell of a lot sooner than that.
I think Steve Bidoff is great in what he does, but there's guilt attached to everything when you're a mother, isn't there?
Yeah,
like you just spend, not just a mother, a father as well, but I just find being a mother, because that's my experience, every single thing is filled with guilt.
Exactly. And like, you know what? I think you're spot on, Danny. I think the biggest, if we make a mistake, all of us, I think the biggest mistake we make is trying to measure every single thing we do. Mm. You know, did I do the drop-off well enough?
Yes.
Have I thought through lunches well enough? You know, have I balanced my work and my home life well enough? Mm-hmm. And we just need to give ourselves a break and just enjoy life a bit and relax maybe. And I think maybe that would make life a bit more, I don't know, straightforward or something.
But I think the fact we're talking about it is good. You know,
yes.
Talking about it, acknowledging it, no idea to solve it, but hey, we're working on talking about it. The first step, right?
Yeah, and we're talking to each other, and that's good too.
Going back to the book, see how we always go on these tangents, which I love. I love. They're important. They're important things to talk about. But what I did love, and it comes, you know, it's a great segue, is the complexity of family. And we just talked about that and talked about not feeling good enough. And even though that's kind of written a little bit differently in The Scholar, it's still there, isn't it? Because it's still so important to all of us, I think.
I think so. I think families are endlessly fascinating, how they relate to each other, how they love each other or fail to love each other, and, you know, how we kind of sort of maybe put a little bit too much pressure on our families sometimes to be all things to us, you know, to provide all that love and approval, and that's not always the easiest thing for a relationship either. I do like Carrie's relationship. I'm interested in that one. I'd like to spend more time with her as a character in the future if I get a chance, because I'm kind of interested in that dynamic with her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not a bad guy. You know, he's a decent too, and he does love her. Really, he does. He just wants a life that just doesn't exist anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you how they're going
to figure that out is kind of interesting to me.
Exactly. And how that kind of defines you as well, not only the family that you build for yourself, but, you know, your ancestors and your parents and your grandparents and how those things define you as well. And I mean, I think we see that a lot in Carlene.
Yes. Oh, poor Carlene.
Poor Carlene.
She's the one I feel so badly for. She isn't perfect either. Poor Carlene, she came from, so for anybody who's listening, I guess, who hasn't read the book, Carlene is 20. I think in the book, and she is a student and is widely known to be absolutely brilliant, you know, just genius level IQ and inspired and extremely hardworking and extraordinarily self-controlled. And her grandfather is John Darcy, and he started a company in Ireland, I guess it was 20 or 30 years before, which has grown to become a massive multinational pharmaceutical company. But Carlene is very much the black sheep. She's her father, who has passed away, was also sort of a bit of a playboy and a bit of a black sheep, but she very definitely is a black sheep and not accepted by her family at all. And so everything she does, every choice she makes, is about trying to gain the approval of her grandfather and trying to be accepted into this fold. And, you know, obviously that's not a very good, that's not a positive way to live your life. But I feel, for me anyway, it's a very exaggerated version of what actually a lot of young women feel. Certainly, or they felt when I was growing up in Ireland, there was very much this thing of young women should be not seen and not heard, but sort of pleasing, you know, pleasant and lovely. And that was the sort of behaviour that was rewarded. And we all kind of carried that with us. And I, you know, we kind of grew out of it in our 30s, but it took a while. So I just find her fascinating because she's a very exaggerated version of what a lot of us felt.
And a lot of us feel still in some ways, I think. Not necessarily do it, but, you know, sometimes you feel that pressure to be a certain thing because you're, you know, a woman.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So. Yeah, and I think men get it, you know, as well in a different way. I mean, yeah. Certainly there was huge pressure on boys when I was a kid to be very boyish. Mm-hmm. You got help if you weren't sporty and you weren't outgoing and you didn't like a bit of rough and tumble, because there wasn't a whole lot of room for that. I mean, thankfully, we're all moving past that stuff now.
Yeah,
but I guess, as you said earlier, maybe I hope we're the last generation who have that in such an uncompromising way. Mm. You know, I'm sure there's still a hangover.
Change is slow. All we can do is do it with our own kids, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Try anyway.
Try, that's right. And of course, touching on Carlene, money and power are such an important motif throughout, as well as the shifting power of the police and the wealthy, which I found such an interesting concept.
Yes. I don't you find that interesting, though? Mm. I mean, when we look at the world we're in today, isn't there such a blurred line between state and the wealthy?
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd be very foolish not to think that there are two sets of rules for people a lot of the time, and if you are very wealthy, you know, the rules are different. And what I was interested in the scholar was not having some, you know, obvious corruption where some super wealthy guy has come in and paid off the police or something, but more the sort of more subtle pressures that are brought to bear. So in the situation in the scholar, it's not that the police don't want to investigate something or that they're going to kowtow to John Darcy and everything he says, but more they're very, very aware that if they overcross the line, the lawyers are going to come in, and they are going to come in with endless resources and court cases and reports and media this and media that. And so they are handling him with kid gloves, and they certainly wouldn't do that for somebody else just off the street. So, you know, the subtle corruption is just as bad as the sort of obvious stuff, I think.
Yeah, I found the insights to that just totally fascinating.
Good. Lovely to hear.
Now, I love talking about reveals in crime fiction without spoilers, of course, which means we just skirt around them, really. But revelations are such an important part of crime fiction. How do you plan and pace and plot yours?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm just trying to think. Do I actually plan the reveals as they go? I do plan certain things. I mean, usually when I'm... I think, Danny, the only way I can answer this is by answering the how do I write, which might go on forever. And excuse me, try and make it a bit shorter. For me, the book starts first with a character, some character that I feel a very strong emotional response to. And then I'll write for a while, just freehand in a notebook, all my thoughts about that character and her history or his history, her family background, etc., etc. And then in the course of that, the problems that character is facing would probably start to grow, and so will some of the other characters, you know, just naturally through understanding who her family and friends are. Then I usually write about 20,000 to 30,000 words with a really rough outline. And once I've got that, then I'll do a full outline of the book. So when I do the full outline, I will do things like mark out, you know, where is the sort of... I try to have little crises that are spread out throughout the book, because if I don't do that, you can end up with this kind of baggy middle where it's just happening and, you know, it gets a bit boring for the reader. I'm just trying to think, do I actually plan reveals, though? I suppose I do. You know, I mean, listen, when you're reading all the craft books, they'll say, ask a question and answer a question. So you'll drop something in sideways into a chapter just by half referring to it. It won't necessarily be a really significant thing in the plot, but just a little kind of a side mention of such and such a character's X, Y, and Z. And then you'll answer it. So enough that it raises a question in the reader's mind. And then that question should be answered in the following chapter.
Okay, that's
interesting. That's how you keep the kind of the feeling of movement going through the book. The bigger reveals, I suppose, I do plan in that I know that by a certain point in the book, we have to know who the murderer is in order to see things roll out. I definitely go back and consider the hints that I've dropped earlier in the book at a certain point in the edit to see, is that too obvious? Is it obvious enough? Does it feel like it's a big glaring, you know, glowing light saying, look at this guy? Or is it more subtle than that? Does it feel natural to the character and the flow of the book, or is it feeling a bit contrived? So I definitely go through a process of considering all of that, but it tends to be later during the structural edit.
And do you know all the bad things you're going to do to each character, or does that surprise you sometimes midway?
Definitely sometimes surprises me. That can be a fun bit, you know? And sometimes it's really weird. It feels like, oh my God, I can't believe those two things are actually coming together. And it's like I planned it. Sometimes maybe. You do plan it, but sometimes it's just serendipitous or a new idea will strike you and you just have to go with it. You kind of feel it in your, you almost feel it physically when it's really, really good. That's what Elizabeth George says in her book Right Away when she talks about writing. And she's thinking about, you know, how do I come up with my good ideas and so on. And she said, the problem isn't ideas. You get loads of ideas. It's about figuring out which is a good one. And she says she knows because she can physically feel a response in her body to that idea when she thinks of it, rather than just intellectually going, oh, yes, that seems quite clever.
I like that.
So, yeah, I like that too. And I think that's exactly right. You know when you're on something good because you can just feel it.
I like that idea. I really do. And I really like the idea of the ask a question, answer a question in the following chapter for that movement. Yeah, that's great. That's a great technique. Now I'm really interested in how the writing process for the three books have differed. So, you know, you've got The Ruin, The Scholar, the third book that, you know, is somewhere written.
Yeah.
How did your writing process develop over those three novels?
Oh gosh, it's totally different. If you asked me that question when I was writing each book, I would have given you a completely different answer. with The Ruin, I really had no idea what I was doing. I think I took that old advice of, you know, messy first draft. Mm-hmm. First draft's a bit too much to heart. And I started with a blank page and just wrote. And, you know, it was so hard, Daddy. You know, I remember reading, you know, Stephen King's book, and he recommends you write at least 2,500 words a day in his book on writing. And yep. I thought, oh, God, I can't do 500. Like, this is like pulling teeth. And then, of course, you get faster and speedier. But it was there was no direction. It went all over the place. It had layers and layers of subplots that weren't related to each other. The very first draft of it was just absolutely awful. I think I binned the first 40,000 and started again and rewrote and rewrote and rewrote and rewrote. Until finally it started to come down to something that made sense. But I still feel like the book is kind of structured around a few core scenes that just came beautifully because they came from the heart, you know. With The Scholar, I didn't have the time to write 55 first drafts. You know, I had a year I needed to write the book. So I read a lot, and I had read a lot of craft books. So I had read about different approaches to writing. So I think I pretty much wrote about 40,000. I wrote a rough outline, wrote my 40,000 words, went back and started again, wrote it up to 70,000 words, went back and started again, wrote it up to 100,000 words, and adjusted my outline as I went. But I definitely tried to have an outline pretty consistently. And I thought when I got to the end of The Scholar, that's it, I've cracked it. This is the way I'm going to write every book from now on. This makes sense and it feels right and it's got the right amount of flexibility in it with the right amount of structure. So this is going to be great. And then I came to the third book and I started doing it that way and I tried to do it that way and it just wasn't working. I just felt too restrained and it just needed to be a bit more fluid. So I had an outline, but I just wrote a bit more freely and a bit more intuitively. And I think that's probably what happens as you become more experienced. I think some of it becomes intuitive and you don't need to rely on, you know, structures as much. You feel the book a little bit more. At least that's what I'm hoping. I haven't had my structured edit back yet from my editor. So when I get it, I'll tell you if it worked.
Tell me if it worked. I like that. It's kind of come full circle, hasn't it?
It has a little bit. It really has. And I have to say, I had a lot of fun writing the third book, which is great. I had fun writing The Scholar too, but there was something very joyful towards the end of the third book that I don't want to let go of.
Now, The Ruin was your crime debut, and it was published around the world, top 10 bestseller, named one of LitHub's most anticipated crime, mystery and thrillers of 2018. How does this feel?
It feels completely and utterly silly and ridiculous and mad. And I don't know if it will ever sink in. I mean, there were moments last year where I just, you know, you just keep shaking your head. And I remember at one stage being on stage at Adelaide Writers Festival with Louise Penny, and there were about 500 people in the audience who had all come to see Louise, of course, not me, but I got to be there with her, you know, I got to tell stories with her and hear her and talk to her, and I just kept pinching myself. I was like, this cannot possibly be happening. And then I just stopped trying to make sense of it all. I mean, I just, at a certain point, you just kind of have to say, stop thinking about it. Just do the thing that's in front of you, and the thing after that, and the thing after that. And eventually, someday, when you're back at home in Perth, in the kitchen with the kids or something, you know, you'll have a moment where it'll all hit you, and then you can open a bottle of wine and sit down and talk about it. But in the meantime, just do the next thing. But I'm still just doing the next thing because it hadn't stopped yet. So
yeah, imagine.
It's great fun. I'm very, very lucky. I suppose that's what I'd say, really.
But the kids keep it real for you. It's just as you're feeling kind of a little bit famous, you know, you have to make lunches and clean the house and all those.
Exactly. No, the kids definitely keep it real. There's no great excitement. I did say that to Anna, my lovely editor, one time. I was in HarperCollins and she was walking me out the lift, and I said, now I'm going to go home and nobody will be saying, Mummy, that is the best toast I've had in weeks. I'm so excited about it.
No, they won't. They really won't. I remember someone saying that, saying, oh, you know, the podcast has really taken off, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, I've got my daughter laying on top of me while we're recording this. And, you know, I'm just this sweaty mess. But thanks, because, you know, I'm really not thinking about it.
I really appreciate that. I don't necessarily feel it myself, but that's great. Yeah.
I'm just trying to not get her to breathe so loudly in the microphone.
Exactly right. I had a Skype call with my agent and my editor the other day, and we were all interrupted by kids in the middle of it. But at least we're all on the same page, which is great.
Yeah, you get it. Especially was that guy on the news, was it from the BBC, when his kids walked in and then his wife came and grabbed them?
So funny. That video is awesome.
It's my favourite because he's normalised it, you know. It just happens to us all now.
It's so lovely, actually. It's really nice that is becoming a bit more normal.
Yeah. So you've been obviously very busy writing these two novels, and third one as well, that will be out, I'm guessing, 2020?
Yes, exactly, yes.
We had to remember I had to remember what you were in for a second.
Yeah, me too. I was like, 2020, yep, that's right.
What's next for you, or am I just rushing you now? Am I just putting...
No, I'm already thinking about it. It's funny, my agent keeps saying, just take a break, and I'm like, oh, gosh, I'm a bit itchy. I'll be doing a lot of travel now. So next week I go to Sydney and Newcastle because The Ruin was chosen by Newcastle for the One City, One Book libraries, which is really exciting.
Wow.
So I'm going over for that. And then I'm home in Perth for a week. I've got the launch here and quite a few events and different things going on here. And then I go for about 3 weeks of touring around the place. So Brisbane and Canberra and Sydney and Melbourne. And then Belfast, Dublin, Galway. And then I'm home. And then I'm pretty much home for the rest of the year, bar Sydney Writers Festival, possibly Adelaide, and there might be a trip to the States later in the year. That's a bit under discussion at the moment. So
wow, and when will you find time to write? On the plane?
Yeah. So I don't really have a lot. I've only got a few weeks before I start going. So I'm muddling around with the story at the moment that I'm kind of having fun writing. And beyond that, I'm just thinking, I'll have my structural edit notes back by the time I come back from this travel. So then I'll be editing for 6 or 8 weeks, and then I'll start writing the fourth book.
Fantastic.
And I don't know what that's going to be. I've got 3 or 4 different ideas I like, but I'm waiting to see which one of them rises to the top before I start writing.
Well, you get that tingly feeling we were talking about before, that emotional response.
Exactly. I think they aren't quite baked enough. I think they need other things to add into them before they start becoming something that really has the juice to support a novel. I think I always need a few ideas to come together in one before it starts to grow, and I'm not quite there yet. So it's too soon to start writing it. So I'm just going to muddle around the story while I wait for that to happen in the back of my head.
And that's what writers say, don't they? I'm staring at the wall, but I'm working. I'm actually working.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I absolutely, honestly, thoroughly enjoyed those two books. I read them, devoured them, really, just one straight after the other. And so I'm really looking forward to the third one.
Thank you. I have to edit it. It would be good when it's finished. It's working.
But I know, I really enjoyed them. And in terms of crime fiction, they've got everything in them that crime fiction lovers like. And as well, all that other stuff that we talked about it as well. You know, all those subplots that we talked about. So that was so fantastic. So thank you so much for taking time out to talk about them.
Not at all. Thank you. It was such a pleasure to talk to you, Danny.